WA2SAY, K2RIW, are you checking in?
A lot of noise on your signal. I don't know what's the matter with it.
It will have noise from time to time. Doug, are you checking in tonight? You usually have some pretty good questions.
Doug, am I in or out?
It is. I have a SDR module that supposedly tones from 100 kilohertz to 1.7 gigahertz. Has a mixer in it with a 100 megahertz local oscillator, and I need some software for Linux. And it looks like there's something called GNU Radio, which is very complicated, and you have to program the damn thing in code, software code, you know, instead of just having a screen come up that you can use. So I wonder if there's anybody out there that has any kind of suggestion as to what software might be available that give me a usable screen that I don't have to program anything with.
Doug, did you tell us what operating system you're running? Is it a Linux or a Microsoft system you're running?
PC Linux, PCLINUXOS.
Okay, that's a kind of a question that either Eric or Roy probably has an answer. Let's see if either one is volunteering an answer. K2RIW, if you're listening.
I didn't catch what kind of operating system he's using, Dick.
He's using a Linux system, and he wants to use that SDR. Doug, why don't you repeat your question so that Eric can know all the details. K2SAY, K2RIW.
Okay, I have a little SDR module which claims to tune from 100 kilohertz to 1.7 gigahertz in two ranges. It uses an internal mixer with a solid state switch, which can be switched to HF or VHF range, and two inputs, one low band, one high band. I'm trying to run this thing off of a Linux system, a PC Linux OS, so that I don't have to resort to Windows, because I think Windows is a real pain in the ass, to tell you the truth. So I wonder if there's anything. I have looked into GNU Linux. GNU Radio. I'm sorry, GNU Radio, GNU Radio, and it's really complicated. Okay, I timed out here, apparently. You have to code the damn thing in computer code, and I'm not up to that anymore. I'm too old.
I got it. You're using SPI, there's a couple of GNU Radio coins out there. All right, well, I'm just trying to think of a package that's already put together. If you're talking Windows, it'd be very easy. There's something called SDR Shark, and it's pretty universal and knows just about every board and card out there. Give me about a minute, and I'm just doing a little search here. I'm trying to find a package that's already together, because most people that run from Linux will go to the... I'm going to drop for a second. They'll go to the GNU sharing sites, a number of different places where you, in essence, the code will be there, but you will still have to compile it. Some of them depend upon which version of Linux you're running, whether you're running Debian or Red Hat or various different types, and the software will be tailored to that particular system with the stuff that's already put together. I'm going to throw it back to you, Dick, and give me a minute and I'll try and come up with an answer for you.
Okay, great. The system I'm using, PC Linux or Linux or whatever you call it, PC Linux OS, is compatible with Red Hat, so if you have an RPM, I can use it.
All right, let me see if I can find something. Back to you to K2RW, K3J. K2RW, K6D, PC.
The, what was I going to say? We have to make sure we give enough of a gap so that people who are maybe on IRLP or Echolink have a chance to sign in. Stand by a minute. Yeah, it looks like the map, which, no matter which input I use, I'm noisy tonight. But that will clear up a little bit later. So, anyone to check in, give me a call that is a name right now. If you happen to be Linux or IRLP, K2RW listening.
And I got an answer ready. Let's see if there's anybody on the outside first. It takes about 5 seconds.
This is AC2IS with a comment.
AC2IS, go ahead, Bill.
I have used SDR Sharp on the Windows platform, was pretty happy with that. Doing a few web searches and a package called GQRX for Linux, which I have not used before, comes up in a couple places as a good SDR package. So I cannot experience with it, but that's something to try, AC2IS.
Thank you. I will try both of those, SDR Sharp or GQR. I've heard of GQRX before, but I have never used it. And I just have this radio just a little while and have never actually turned it on until now. And I tried the GNU radio, and it's, you know, if you're not a programmer, you might as well forget about it.
I was going to come back with SDR Sharp. I see there's a bunch of different versions of it. There's a lot of the different packages in Linux. Now, it all depends upon what the radio is and whether or not you've got the driver running on it. So, if you do a Google search, you'll find a whole bunch of stuff that will tell you how to set it up and how to operate it.
Do that. I did that some a year or two ago with a different radio, and I did find a little bit, but not too much.
It might be helpful, Eric, if you mentioned what search words you used with Google, and that might help Doug. Back to you, Eric.
Easiest thing you can do is just type Linux, L-I-N-U-X, SDR Sharp, and go from there. You can also do Linux SDR, and then it'll come up with a bunch of different stuff. It's pretty simple.
W-H-A-H-U-S-A-Y, thank you very much, and I'll be listening out.
Sounds good, Doug. Depending on how well it works, please come back and let us know that it did work or didn't work. Maybe even get a chance to try it out tonight, if you know what I mean. Okay. Anyone else with questions or comments for the TechNet? Give me a call, let us right now. I know you can teach you how... I know you can keep your eyes up if you're listening.
By the way, Dick, the alternates are available if you need them.
K2RIW, K6DPC. Dick, I would not...
Okay, I see this one's working. And this one is working too. Although I'm always a little bit noisy on this one.
WS2N, how am I coming in, Dick?
Very well. Stand by a minute. Yeah, Paul, you sound right. So, Paul, do you have for the... Here we go. Do you have a question or a comment tonight, Paul? Go ahead.
No. I just urge everybody trying out the transmitters. So I thought I'd do the same thing. Not at this time, Dick, but I will be here.
AC1SAM with a quick question.
Mister,
SAM, Goretta. Goretta head SAM.
Thanks, Dick. Did we ever find out what was causing Roy to drop out like he was dropping out? It doesn't seem to happen very much anymore, and I never heard why.
Rich? Yeah. I a yucky microphone here. I'm pretty sure that Eric found one of the causes of that of the dropout. Why don't you give us a few words on that, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Yeah, we had a an issue with the duplexer where the isolation was not very good. We've got another temporary duplexer in there now, but right now we're fighting what looks like it looks like there's a new transmitter or something up there that's causing mixing products, so that makes people who would normally have a really good strong signal appear weak at times. I haven't I'm supposed to get up there tonight, but unfortunately I had to work. And I was gonna put the TDR on and just look at the integrity of the cable going up to the antenna, the jumper on the antenna itself, but I'll probably get to do that tomorrow. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, K2J.
Yeah, when you replaced the duplexer, it made a huge improvement to the blast of noises that we're hearing in the background. And then a day or two later, some of that noise came back. I guess you're saying another transmitter suddenly appeared and gave extra grief. Is that what's going on, Eric?
Yeah, you got to remember, I'm remotely monitoring the receivers AGC, and I see a signal that's kind of saturating the receiver that when I get up there and I hook a spectrum analyzer up to it, I'll know what it actually is, but it's making the receiver a little bit deaf at times.
Well, that other signal to get through that duplexer and still be off frequency and strong enough to overload the receiver front end, that's a difficult requirement. I mean, those six cavities, the three cavities on the receiver, you would think would eliminate a signal that's on some other frequency. Over to you, Eric.
Now, believe it or not, there's actually another cavity on the receive side, which, you know, I suffer a little inflation loss over it, but you gotta remember, one cavity is not very narrow, so, you know, if there's, say, an offending signal on, I guess, 225, and it's really strong, there's no way I'm gonna keep that out of it.
The current duplexer has how many cavities altogether? And I think you said you added another one to the receiver, and previous to that there was only one in the duplexer? That's a little confusing. Go ahead.
Now, the duplexer that's up there now is six cavities, okay? And it has a measured isolation of, I guess, around, almost 100. But, you know, six cavities isn't eight cavities, it's not 10 cavities, it's really, you know, three on each side, so, and in addition to that, there's one more cavity on the receive side before it hits the receiver.
The one more cavity, that's something you added, or you're talking about the normal front end of the receiver, Eric? Go ahead.
Well, whoever put the system together originally added that additional cavity, and it actually helps with some of the stuff up there because there's an awful lot of energy coming down there, the antenna.
That's an extremely dense environment with a lot of RF on a lot of frequencies where that repeater is located. Do you have a high confidence and all of the jumper cables in the cavity that none of them are crimp connectors that are doing a little bit of leakage, 80 dB down, so to speak? Over to you, Eric.
Yeah, I have pretty high confidence as far as the the stuff that's inside the room goes. Right now, I don't have high confidence in the cable that leads up to the roof and the jumper cable that goes from the 3/4-inch cable down to something that plugs into the antenna. That's why I'm bringing the TDR to see what I can find.
Yeah, time domain reflectometer is a very handy item, sort of a radar inside of a cable, and it can find every bump, every connector, and so on. It can't find leakage per se, but it can certainly find perturbations. But it can't really tell you what's going on with the standing wave ratio of the antenna, because it's a narrow band device. The TDR puts out a very sharp pulse, which represents a whole lot of frequencies at once. The antenna will only accept one of those frequencies, reject all the others. Therefore, the antenna itself is always going to give you a big reflection on a TDR. I don't think anybody's found a solution to that one. Maybe you know of one to get around that. How do you, Eric, KQLIW?
All right, well, let's step back for a second and know that at one point we had a system that worked perfectly well. So we know that we can accomplish the task, so something has changed. What has changed at this point, haven't narrowed it down yet. As far as the TDR goes, as long as I'm measuring time and I'm not really caring about frequencies so much at this stage of the game, I should be able to identify where the connectors are and where the antenna is in terms of distance and how much of a disturbance that those joints create. So that's going to give me some indication of the integrity of this system. Now, the only problem that I have at this point is I haven't figured out that 3/4-inch cable, what the velocity factor is, because I haven't been able to find any labeling on it inside the place that tells you what the heck kind of cable it is, so I can figure out look up the velocity factor. So I'm probably going to wind up taking a guess at it.
The velocity factor of the cable means that if you see a bump that looks like it's 15 feet downrange, and it might really be 14 or 16 feet, that's a minor detail. And even if a connector was slightly leaky, I mean, unless the connector has a great big open gap, it's going to have 80 dB of shielding. So for an extra signal to get in through a slightly faulty connector, as opposed to coming down the antenna, I don't think there's a great deal of difference there. So I'm not convinced that a slightly defective connector could be creating this problem, but maybe I'm a little bit naive here. And back to you, Eric.
Now, as you know, in the past, we've had some water issues. Now, I've not seen it. I've only gotten the reports after it was taken care of. And I have seen situations where a little teeny bit of corrosion or oxidation on a pin sometimes acts like a diode, and then it becomes a huge mixer.
Okay, now you're on to it. Yep. Passive intermodulation distortion in connectors can make a mixer out of the zillions of frequencies you've got on that rooftop, and therefore some of those frequencies make combinations that fall on 146.25. Okay, a leaking connector can give you a lot of grief, and I guess that's one of the main reasons that a otherwise good connector suddenly starts creating passive intermodulation distortion. I guess a slightly flaky contact of dissimilar metals, you got to be very careful as to what kind of plating is on connectors that are being mated, and I guess you don't have a great deal of control over that. It's the riggers that are allowed to be on the roof that do that. Over to you, Eric, KQLIW.
Right, KQLIW, KQJ. Well, in this case, we have Billy, who's the owner, proprietor, or Elliot's right-hand man. So the thing with that is I wanted to, you know, do as much information gathering as I can before I bring him into the mix. So it's kind of the right thing to do, because he's a busy guy, blah, blah, blah. That's to give someone, you know, information as much as you can gather before you bring him in, and then we'll go from there. I mean, he's very amenable to doing anything I ask, but I want to know what I'm talking about before I have him start doing stuff.
When it comes to the TDR function you're now discussing, there's at least two different kinds of TDRs. One really works in the time domain by putting out brief pulses. The other one is a fancy program that works with a vector network analyzer that sweeps all the frequencies, measures all the phases, puts it all together with a Fourier transform program, and emulates a TDR. So which kind of TDR do you have? If you have the second one, I bet you there's all kinds of additional tests that could be done with that via vector network analyzer. Over to you, Eric, K2IW.
USAY.
That's what we can see in a second. Well, you know, I have that big beast. I'm not bringing that thing up there. But I have an initial site master, a cell master on this particular model, which is specifically designed for these kinds of problems. And I also have a real pocket-sized vector network analyzer that I put up against the big beast, and it's pretty damn close. And this TDR function is in the time domain, and it is a series of pulses. So, between the two of them, I'm pretty sure I can get a fairly accurate picture. Back to you, Dick, and pick up the new station. K2IW, K2J.
Okay, we've waited for all the beeps. Doug, go right ahead with your additional information. W2SAY, K2IW.
Okay, I just wanted to insert here that I have built the little circuit that's in the handbook for building a time domain reflectometer board. It's just a pulse generator, really. But the problem is you need a really good scope to use the thing. I have a 200 megahertz scope, and it's not good enough. You need something like, I don't know, at least 500 megahertz, I think, to have a really useful TDR measurement. My scope just won't respond to a 10 nanosecond pulse. And, you know, it's a pretty good scope. It's a Tektronix. It's a, but it's just limited, band limited. So WA2SAY, back to that.
The TDRs, Doug, are not putting out a 10 nanosecond pulse. They're putting out a much longer pulse, but only using the sharp rise time of the beginning of that pulse for the TDR function. That kind of a pulse generator, I think your scope would, your 200 meg scope should give you a pretty good response. Back to you, Doug.
Well, I have a pulse generator. I can generate anything from about 10 nanoseconds to milliseconds. I don't know how long, but I didn't find, I've been trying to make some measurements a few months ago on an antenna system, and I didn't, on a cable system, and I didn't have much happiness with anything I did. So I just wanted to inject that, you know, somebody goes to a whole lot of trouble building a generator with puts out very narrow pulses. You may be wasting your time. And I also have a pulse generator, an actual physical device, you know, a commercial device, which puts out very narrow to very wide or whatever size pulse you want. And I was never satisfied with the results. So I just wanted to inject that. WA2SAY, back to that.
Doug, what do you believe is the rise time on your particular pulse generator? And is there a way you can confirm that? I mean, if the pulse generator, for some reason, has a slightly slanted rise time, then the TDR function becomes a lot more difficult to carry out. Over to you, Doug.
I think I don't really know, but let me see. I think I can look at the thing right now, if you stand by just a second. Let me see if I can find, where did I put it? let me see, yeah, I can see it, hang on a second. I think it's pretty darn quick. Let me see what it says. It has a range. Oh, its narrowest is 109. Well, the full scale is 100. Let me see. No.
Any question?
Down a second, it looks like. But I can't see that. Doesn't matter.
Ask the question about a 2-meter weak signal array, horizontal, polarized, or vertical.
It's not 2 meters, it's low band.
Yeah, there's a person signing in who wants to be on the list. Right after we finish discussing this subject, we'll go to your subject, sir. So the new person signing in, for the time being, just give us your call letters and your name, sir. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
I want to be signed in, and 2EM.
Get back in. It was 2 meters. I'm sorry. I was looking at a 2-meter antenna. It's a big vertical.
What a question.
Okay. You were a little bit too quick. You were talking first and then squeezing the mic later. Squeeze the mic. Wait a second, and please give us your call letters and name once again, sir. Go right ahead. Getting maximum dynamic range out of a real time domain reflectometer. I wonder if they use some kind of a technique so that during the transmitting pulse is somehow gated and doesn't overload the scope so that the real echo, which is going to be a significant number of dB weaker, can still be resolved on the screen. So is there any kind of a bucking circuit or a gating circuit to keep from overloading the scope during the transmitted pulse of a TDR? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
DPZ, a TR-tube, I've done it. TR.
Wait, K2RIW, K2EJ. Oh, well, one of the problems that people have is the triggers in the scope, they don't bother to trigger from the thoughts that they're sending out. And the scope has issues with looking at what's being reflected back. Which edge am I going to trigger on? If you trigger the scope from the original source, you should have no problem seeing it, whether it's 3 dB down, 6 dB down, it'll be there.
I agree, this is WA2SAY. I have done this some years ago when I was still working, and even if it's 10 dB down, you should be able to see it with no trouble at all. You're not going to overload it with the pulse that you put out.
Yeah, that's a good point, Eric. 10 dB down, the voltage is 1/3, and so that's not requiring a great deal of dynamic range out of the oscilloscope. I think a good oscilloscope can look at a pulse that's 5% of the full screen, of the amplitude of the transmitted pulse, and I guess that would be something like a 26 dB down, so that's a still pretty good TDR function. And 20 some odd dB down is a very small fraction of a standing wave ratio, something like 1.15. I guess there are vector network analyzers that, when properly tuned, can see a S11 signal, numbers like 50 dB down. Your particular VNA, what's your guess, Eric, as to how many dB down of S11 it can resolve, particularly in the narrow band, instantaneous bandwidth mode? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. Well, if you're talking about the big guy, I've used it to see stuff that's 100 dB down pretty easily. And then some. But the little guys that I'd be carrying around, the Enritsu actually has a specification. I don't know what it is. But my Neo portable VNA, I trust it to go maybe minus 70, minus 80, no problem.
If you're discussing an S11 of minus 70, I think that's a 1.0001 standing wave ratio. Ridiculous. Over to you, Eric.
Yeah, it is. I mean, when you look at the turn loss, I think the little guys around, I don't remember now, I think it was like minus 60 or minus 50, somewhere in that neighborhood.
Back in the old-fashioned amplitude-modulated television days, you want your S11 of your transmitting antenna system to be extremely low, otherwise it creates ghosts in the picture right at the transmitter. So what was your particular requirement for S11 of the transmitting antenna across its 6 megs of bandwidth? Over to you, Eric.
Actually, in the digital world, it's a little, really a lot better than what we had in the analog world, but, let's see. Give me a second. I got the chart, and I can tell you exactly what this antenna is. I think it's like 1 to 1.03 something or 02 something. It's somewhere in that neighborhood.
So you're guessing that the S11 is something like minus 40 dB?
Yeah, somewhere in that neighborhood. Probably a little teeny bit more.
I would guess that after the antenna is installed, it requires a little fine tweaking to achieve that, because there must be some minor perturbations with a particular transmission line installation, with its elbows and all that other jazz, and spark arresters and so on.
Up at the top of the tower, at the bottom of the antenna, there's five screws, like five little tweakers. Then down at the bottom, because it's a straight line down, there's an elbow, and there's, I think that one has four tuners on it. That takes another turn, come into the building. That one's straight. And then there's another one inside the building that heads back towards the transmitter. That's got a set of screws on it. And then what comes out of the mass filter, and the mass filter is a filter that makes slopes that is 60 dB down, what is it, 0.2 of a megahertz away. Yeah, there's a bunch of screws. And you can actually tweak it pretty tight.
In a laboratory, when a technician, an engineer, is tuning up a duplexing filter, he's tuning it with instrumentation that assumes that the antenna is a perfect 50-ohm load DC to light. And you might be able to adjust your particular six-cavity duplexer for maybe considerably more than 100 dB of isolation. When that duplexer is then connected to a real antenna, which is a little bit different from a 50-ohm resistor at the transmit and receive frequency, I believe that a slight touch-up of the tweaking controls on site can reestablish a little bit more isolation with the real antenna. Have you ever seen any characteristics like that, Eric? Over to you, Eric, K2RIW.
No, I've not seen anybody do it with a duplexing filter. I've seen it with other types of filters where it's, you actually have a signal tap in line, which is basically, you know, in hard line, you drill a hole, and you put what looks like a bird slug in there, looking at the center conductor, and you actually can do your tweaking there. I've never seen anybody do it with single frequency duplexes, like we have on two-way radio stuff, because don't forget, I work on broadcasting, that two-way radio stuff is hobby time for me.
There must be a way of putting a spectrum analyzer on the receiver port, sampling the receiver port, and with narrow band setting of the spectrum analyzer, you will find the leakage of the transmitter coming through. What you got to worry about, though, is that you're in the presence of the transmitter putting out a potent signal to the antenna, which is a small number of feet away from all of your test equipment. So leakage paths into the test equipment could create a false alarm here. But that kind of sampling in the real in situ situation, I think would allow a little bit of final tweaking of the duplexer's controls to get a little bit more on-site transmitter to receiver isolation. That's the isolation that creates the receiver overload that starts giving you intermodulation distortion. Over to you, Eric, K2RIW. 2IW, K2J.
Well, I'll give you this. I actually, when I put the duplex in, because you know that the loads aren't going to be precisely the same, I actually look at the receiver's IF, and when there's a little bit of leakage, you see it as a DC voltage. And you just very carefully do your nulls and watch that voltage and make it go as low as you can make it go, which should be into the noise. And when everything's right, I can turn the transmitter on, see nothing in the receiver, and I can have a signal calling in, turn the transmitter on and off, and see nothing change. So that's as best as I can do in my world. I suppose I could split the input to the receiver with a, you know, 3 dB splitter and watch it that way, but I think the receiver's IF is good enough.
Yeah, but the receiver's IF, the DC voltage you're talking about, I presume is coming from either an amplitude detector or a limiter stage, whereas a scanning spectrum analyzer set with, let's say, a 1KC resolution bandwidth can really dig down and see a weak signal. And I think you get even a little bit a deeper null in that condition, Eric. Go ahead.
Yeah, I got you. I actually believe the spectrum analyzer that I have goes to about minus 110. It's kind of hard to see stuff down there. It's kind of noisy.
Not to worry about is that a spectrum analyzer front end quite often has a 20 or a 30 dB noise figure. So if you could tap into the receiver beyond its RF amplifier stage or into the first IF, it almost doesn't matter, but someplace where there's some real front end gain of the receiver for the pickoff point for the spectrum analyzer. Now the sensitivity limitation of the spectrum analyzer goes away, and you can dig quite a bit deeper in that case, I believe. So just a splitter in front of the receiver may not be good enough, because most barefoot spectrum analyzers have a 20 or so dB noise figure. You can make a spectrum analyzer flat, you can make it sensitive. You can't make it sensitive and flat. And even if the spectrum analyzer that has a preamplifier you can turn on, that preamplifier is broadband and therefore can very easily be overloaded in that environment. Over to you, Eric, K2LIW. K2LIW,
KTJ. I'm not sure I ever showed you. I think I did. I think I showed you the RSSI signal that I had that actually stole out on a graph. And I've actually got it calibrated. So I have it calibrated so that each half a microvolt at the bottom end of the scale. Whereas when I originally set the thing up, I fed, you know, 0.1 of a microvolt, 0.2 of a microvolt, and I actually measured the actual voltages, which relates to the graph, and it goes logarithmic up the scale. So, now, I have fairly good confidence in what I can see, as far as the receiver's concerned. But no, I follow what you're saying exactly, and, you know, that's another experiment.
What do you believe is the instantaneous bandwidth of the stage in front of the RSSI circuit? That particular stage might be 15 kilohertz broad, 10 kilohertz broad, whereas the spectrum analyzer in the narrow scan mode could be using a 100 hertz filter. Therefore, it could have 15 or 20 dB of an additional sensitivity to a weak signal that you're trying to null out, as opposed to the RSSI. Over to you, Eric.
Yeah, okay. I'll grant you that the voltage that's being generated is I believe it's after the filter.
But anyway, yeah, I mean, we're talking on frequency here. We're not looking off to the sides, you know, to the left or the right. Again, you know, the thing used to work perfectly fine. So, it's a matter of finding out what's new, what's different. Why is it doing this? I mean, yeah, we knew that the other duplex did drift, and it has drifted in the past, twice, actually, in the 6 or 8 years it's been there. And actually, we've got a different model duplex in there right now, having a similar issue as the other duplex did, but a lot less bad than the other duplex.
Every transmitter has some spectral purity, noise, and sidebands. So in the case of the transmitter that's part of the repeater, it's the 600 KCOA noise that you're really knowing. Therefore, I'm suddenly backing off on what I've been saying. You can't set a spectrum analyzer to be more sensitive to noise. There is no CW signal coming down that IO strip from your own transmitter. It's only the noise sidebands, 600 KCOA. Therefore, I'm in your ballpark. I believe you did it the right way. How are you, Eric?
No, I hate to say, when you're the king of RF, when you speak, I listen to you. Yeah, no, I did what makes sense to me. I mean, I'm looking at it right now, and the transmitter is not affecting the receiver at all. There's no problems at this particular moment. So, actually, I'm transmitting with a very weak signal that barely makes it to Glen Oaks, because I'm using a receiver that's closer to me. And I see no effect in what the receiver itself is doing. So, but at some point, I'll see something, because there's another source somewhere.
Yeah, where are you going to do that monitoring to try to find that other signal? Are you thinking of tapping in various places in the cables of the repeater?
Well, when I finally get up there, the first order of business is to put the TDR on it and see if anything looks unusual. Yeah, get that out of the way and be happy with it. Then it'll probably be disconnecting the antenna from the system, plug it straight into the spectrum analyzer, and see what's nearby, and see what's right there on frequency. At least now I'll have the ability to look over a wide swath of frequencies and see what's strong coming down.
Yeah, that's best. However, some of those signals, when they come on from only a small number of feet away, they could overload the living daylights out of your spectrum analyzer, Eric.
Yeah, well, that's why they always find the 20 dB bands in front of my spectrum analyzer. Actually, there was a time, I think it was about 10 years ago, where something happened and they were getting, like, you could put your bird watt meter on it and read, like, 2 or 3 watts coming back at you. But that was before my time. That was the story I was told, so. I don't know. Just keep digging. Eventually we'll find it.
To get a watt out of your receiving antenna would require a transmitting antenna with 100 watts of output only a few feet away. So, wow. That's a lot of steam. And you'd certainly like to move that antenna a little bit if you could. You're receiving antenna to get away from that guy. Oh, you, Eric.
At that particular point in time, they moved the antenna to the side of the building. And that problem went away. That was a long time ago. Again, we used to not have this problem, so gotta figure out why. I mean, it could be one of his other transmitters just putting out spurious all over the place. And lucky us, it just happened to sit right on top of it. And again, the problem is intermittent, and like now, it's not happening because it's late Sunday night and nobody's transmitting. Comes Monday morning, it'll be a totally different story.
Casey, when SAM comments?
Sam? Once again, go ahead, Sam.
Yeah. Any chance you can just ask the powers that be there? Someone has to be in charge of what goes up there. And just ask, what's new? What's been added in the last few months or whatever? And maybe you can work from there. And you, at least you know what you're up against.
No, that's the first question that's going to be asked.
So I think you're saying there is a site manager that has a great big record book and keeps track of everything that's added and subtracted. Is that true, Eric?
Well, not only that, there's actually a Intermod sheet that was calculated based on every transmitter on the facility. By the way, there's a limitation to the number of antennas that can be put on the roof, simply because the fire department controls that. It's kind of silly. And they count every antenna, whether it's a GPS antenna, a transmitting antenna, or just a piece of wire. It creates a lot of headaches for them, so... Now, of course, the first question I'll ask Billy is, did you put anything new up there? Because I see things have been moved. And I actually haven't done any sniffing to see if there's anything leaking in the room. But, you know, those questions will get asked, and eventually, hopefully, we'll narrow it down to something.
Eric, tell me why the fire department limits the number of antennas on the roof. I can't see an antenna creating a fire, so I don't see the relationship here. Over to you.
New York City government got everything to do with it. And there's some fire gear up there, and it, you know, they consider it the New York FD radio roof. It's more complicated than that, but it's city government.
So I guess what I'm hearing is it's not the normal fire department requirement of fire safety. It is their fire department repeater function. They want to make sure there's no interference to it. Is that what's going on?
I don't know if that's actually the case. The next time I see Billy, I will ask him. But it's something like that. Although, if you look at some of the other buildings in the other counties, like in Nassau County, there's no such thing as a rule like that.
So it sounds like this is unique to Glen Oaks. Okay. I think Rich wanted to say something to us. N2 Echo Oscar, K2RIW. Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, Dick, you were on a different subject. First, on this subject, I have to say my gratitude, I think we should all have gratitude to Eric, because if we hadn't paid a service contract, Delta Weimark repeaters wouldn't be able to afford it. You ever think? Okay. What I wanted to say, Dick, was, sometimes asking questions of an individual is helpful. Maybe remember I told you Linux not working out for me. A lot of my important programs that I really needed wouldn't run under Linux. I mentioned people that wanted to go back to Microsoft. I planned to buy a disk from Amazon.com, a brand new Microsoft. Anyway, I spoke to Steve, WB2ZFE. Gave me the best advice ever. He said to me, why do I contact Jewel Packard, who made the computer? And it was right on the ball. They sold me for $60 a restart-up disk with all the drivers, everything, including Microsoft Windows 10. All I had to do was plug it in, it hit the ground running, it took a few hours, it installed Windows 10 with all the necessary UART contractor, drivers, everything was done. Because Steve had a bite on the bolt. You, Dick.
Sounds like you had a successful operation there, Rich. Well done. I know that Frank, KE2 Kilo Bravo, had a question that he mailed to me that I wasn't able to answer him. I wonder if he's on frequency. Frank, are you available? KE2 KB, K2RIW. Okay, I guess Frank is not there tonight. Okay, I think we've gone down the list of people who signed in. With a little bit of a delay. We're going to give a nice long delay if anyone wants to sign in from EchoLink or IRLP. I do so right now. K2LIW listening.
WS2N.
Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah. I wanted to ask a question about the Tesla car. They said the Tesla car does not come with an AM radio. I wonder if you've heard that. And I'm trying to figure out why not. You know, I haven't looked that much into it. But my guess is that maybe it causes interference, the AM band. Very odd. It's a very expensive car that you can't get AM radio. I'd be lost without AM radio, you know. I listen to that all the time. Just wonder if you heard this. I heard this on one of the, I guess it was a business station on TV. You know, they talk about business, different things that are coming out. Back to you, sir.
The brushless DC motors that are at the wheels, or maybe in front of the transmission, but the brushless DC motor used on an electric automobile creates some very complicated signals at just the right rise times and slants and whatever. So when it comes to interference in the 0 to 1 megahertz band, I can see how it can create an awful lot of it. That's my guess. Let's see what Eric's got to say. I'll bet you a modern-day brushless DC motor-fed automobile can create a lot of AM noise on that radio. What do you think, Eric? K2RIW.
K2IW, K2J. Well, I don't really know what the answer is, but my guess is that all the damn computers in the car make AM radio listening just about impossible. Although my son has a Model 3, and when I see him, I will try and listen to AM radio near that car and see what we get. I mean, I have a hybrid. It makes HF pretty unusual, but yet, if you tune in between stations, the amount of racket that you hear coming out of the AM radio is a lot of racket. So, that's my guess anyway. K2RIW, K2J.
Yeah, thank you, Eric. Paul, the lack of an AM radio, is that something recent? Or on almost all of these electric vehicles, has that been there for a long time? What do you think? You got a poll.
They just said the new Tesla, whichever one that is, I'm not sure which model that is. They've had like, you know, I could think two or three of them. So I'm just wondering if there's a reason for it. My daughter has a Prius, what kind of car is that? I forget the year. Here. That might have been the rented one. They had a rented one for a while. But the hybrid cars still have AM radio in it. But for some reason, this Tesla is probably a $40,000 car. I don't know what they cost. It does not have it.
AC2GS?
This is, keeps coming up is that the motor in the Tesla makes too much racket.
You've got it, Roy.
Yeah, Eric had it right. The BMW i3 and the Tesla Model X or 10, whatever they call it, both ditched the AM radio because the motors apparently produce too much background noise, and for the price that people are paying for a car, they don't want a staticky AM radio. So they just pulled it out, is my understanding as well.
and I guess with sufficient filtering, by the time you get up to the 88 megacycle FM band, you manage to make the electronics quiet enough. You still have good FM reception. I presume also a significant number of people with that kind of a high-end automobile also use satellite radios in their cars. What do you guys think about that?
Until we up.
Go ahead, Rich.
Yes. I wonder if maybe AM radio may be too high for a lot of people that spend money on an expensive car. I don't feel that way, but maybe they do.
AC2GS, I would think that satellite transmission radio broadcasts are very popular in these types of cars, so that's probably another reason why they felt that they could get rid of AM, and a lot of people would just switch to the satellite-based radio broadcast.
Okay, one more time, we're going to give a great big long gap in case anyone with IRLP or Echolink or... We've heard reports this week, during the week, that people were unable to sign into the TechNet because we didn't give a big enough gap. We're going to give a big enough gap right now. K2RIW, listening.
Good evening, K2.
Hey, stop. He said K2 and then stopped. Who was that?
Young, this is me, Sam. KU2NSC. Yeah, I just wanted to take that minute. It had nothing to do with the radio. It's just that all the vets out there that served and got back home safe, I just want to say congratulations to you.
Okay, thank you, Sam. I think it's time to go over to the science talk. So, Roy, AC2GS, K2IW, please take over, Dr. Roy.
Okay, thank you very much, Dick. This is AC2GS, and as always, I like to mention the information, the email address, and what have you. So, in order to contact me for any questions, any topics, any difference of opinions, it's mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. And everything that I talk about and some things that even Paul talks about will be posted on the site roy.ac2gs.com as well. In addition, there is a chat room that almost no one uses, which is chat.ac2gs.com. So if you want to type me little messages there, you can hang out there and do that. I just want to mention to Doug earlier, because I couldn't get through to the repeater, that probably he should find out what the manufacturer and model of his SDR is, which will give everyone a better opportunity to figure out where the software might become available. So let me drop for a moment, and then I will move on to the science talk. Okay. Along this resolution for next week's general conference on weights and measures could toss out the international prototype of the kilogram. It's a hunk of platinum and iridium in Paris that everyone agrees weighs 1 kilogram. Instead, the International Bureau of Weights and Measures is going to redefine the international system of units to ensure that kilograms are based on things that can't change over time. It would require an entire rethinking of how kilograms really work. As we've discussed in the past, there's reason that scientists rely on a hunk of metal. King Louis XVI created a standardized way to stop tradespeople from scamming customers, which was called the grave, and was equal to a liter of water held at 0 degrees Celsius. In 1795, French leaders decided instead to go with the gram, a cubic centimeter of water held at 4 grams Celsius. The hunk of metal replaced the inconvenient water measurement in 1799, and 17 countries signed a treaty in 1875 to standardize this mass to the international prototype of the kilogram, or as they lovingly call it, la grande K. today, over 100 countries, including the U.S., have signed an agreement to use the International Bureau of Weights